popped up again. Bubbles burst all around it. Then it was gone. "It's a sea turtle," Newton said. They crept down to the shore. The tide pool was hemmed by honeycombed rock. How had the turtle gotten in? Maybe there was a gap in the rocks underwater. More likely, it had gotten carried in with the high tide and was trapped until the tide came in again.
"Could we eat it?"
Max said. His voice was raspy with excitement.
"We could."
Newton's voice held the same anxious rasp. Something about the idea of meat, even turtle meat, was insanely appealing. They doffed their boots and socks and rolled their pant legs up past their knees. A light wind scalloped the water, spitting salt water at their naked legs. The tide pool sloped steeply to a bottom of indeterminate depth. The turtle shell was the size of a serving platter. They could just make out its contours when the turtle poked itself above the surface. Its head was a vibrant yellow, shaded with dark octagon-shaped markings. Its eyes were dark, like a bird's eyes. It had a wise and thoughtful look about it, which was pretty typical of turtles. The boys patted their knives in their pockets. Max had a Swiss Army knife. Newton had a frame-lock Gerber with a 3-inch blade.
"How should we do it?"
Newton whispered with a giddy, queasy smile.
"We have to do it fast. Grab it and drag it out and kill it, I guess, fast as we can."
"Do they bite?"
"I don't know, do they?"
Newton pursed his lips.
"It might if we aren't careful."
They waded gingerly into the pool. The water was so cold it sapped the air from their lungs. The water rose to the nubs of their kneecaps. The turtle was a darker shape in the already dark water. It swung around lazily, unconcerned. As it rose up, the boys caught sight of its shell, a mellow green patina flecked with streaks of magenta. Strands of sea moss drifted off it like streamers on a parade float. It swam right up to them, totally unperturbed. Maybe it was curious, or maybe it was hungry too, and thought the boys might make an easy meal. It swam between Newton's split legs. He trembled from the cold and from the fear that the turtle might snap at his thighs, but it swam through serenely enough. It had four flippers. The two at the front were long sickles, sort of like the wings on a plane. The two at the back looked like bird talons, except with webs of tough connective tissue. The skin on all four flippers was iridescent yellow, overlaid with dark scaling. It was a beautiful creature. Max gritted his teeth and plunged his hands into the water. His fingers closed around the edge of the turtle's shell, which was as slimy as an algae-covered rock. The turtle kicked forcefully. Its strength was incredible. Suddenly, Max was on his knees in the freezing surf. The rocks raked his shins. The turtle's small ebony claws dug into his thighs. He opened his lips to cry out, and when he did, the sea washed in, leaving him choking and sputtering. The turtle slipped out of his grip. He splashed after it blindly.
"Newt, get it before it gets away!"
Newton hobble-walked to where the turtle was throwing itself against the tide pool barrier. He grabbed one of its rear flippers. It was slippery and tough, like a radial tire slicked in dish soap. The turtle swung around and snapped wildly at Newt. Its head telescoped out on its wrinkled neck farther than he'd thought possible. It reminded him of that game, Hungry, Hungry Hippos. Newton let out a fearful holler as its jaws went snack, 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 inches from his face. He caught the briny smell of the turtle's breath and another, more profound scent, something hormonal and raw. He reeled back and nearly tumbled face first into the water. The turtle went back to flinging itself at the rock. Max was breathing heavily through gritted teeth. Water hissed between the chinks with harsh st sounds. The bitter tang of fear washed through Newton's mouth. The situation had developed horrible potential, though he wasn't quite sure how that had happened.
"You grab one flipper," Max said, his eyes squeezed down to slits. "I'll grab the other. We'll get it up on shore. It won't be so tough on land."
They took hold of its back flippers and dragged it out. The turtle's front flippers paddled in useless, oar-like circles. Its head thrashed, sending up fine droplets of water. Max's whitened lips were skinned back from his teeth, more a funhouse leer than a smile. A look of horrible triumph had come into his eyes. They heaved the turtle up onto the sickle of rain-fitted sand. It tried to scuttle up the beachhead but was hemmed in by steep shale. The boys hunched over with their hands on their knees, their kneecaps chapped red with cold,
to collect their breath. The sky had gone dark, an icy vault pricked with isolated stars. A fingernail slice of the moon cast a razored edge of brightness over the sea.
"We should build a fire, Newton said, his teeth chattering.
First we have to kill it. A painful tension had sunk into Max's chest, the pressure of a huge spring coiled to maximum compression. He was angry at the turtle for its mute will to survive and for its defiance of his own needs. He was frustrated that the turtle had scared him. He'd have to kill it for that transgression alone. The turtle turned to face them. Its head was tucked defensively into its shell. It struggled forward on its front flippers, aiming to return to the tide pool. Max stepped in front of it. The turtle's head darted away to snap at his toes. Max pulled his foot away with a strangled squawk. The turtle had taken a V-shaped bite. The wound went a quarter inch into his toe, almost to the nail. Max felt very little. His toes were still numb and his system awash with adrenaline. But as his blood pissed into the sand, he sensed all the threads inside his body gathering up, tightening, and committing themselves to a steely purpose. He'd kill this thing. He wanted it dead. Max found a bit of driftwood and hooked it under the turtle's shell. It wheeled and snapped off 3 inches of bleached wood. Max jammed the remaining portion under its front flipper and levered it up savagely. The turtle flipped onto its back. It uttered a pitiful squall that sounded too much like the cry of a human infant for Newton's ears.
There, Max's chest heaved. There, you fucking tough guy. There you go.
With one trembling finger, he flicked open the largest blade of his Swiss Army knife. Moonlight lay trapped along its honed edge. His anger and fear helixed into each other. Things were speeding up, and yet everything was held in a bubble of crystalline clarity, the tide swelling over the rain-pitted sand and smoothing everything with a layer of silver, the shriek of gulls overhead that seemed to urge him toward an act of savagery he'd already settled his mind around. Max pressed the knife to the turtle's stomach, which was the off-beige color of the rubberized mat in his bathtub at home. The tip slipped into one of the grooves in the turtle's shell as if guided by its own inner voice. Max had never killed anything. Oh, maybe bugs, but did they really count? He'd never stabbed anything, that was for sure. Newton stared at him with eyes that shone like cold phosphorus. Max wished he'd look away. He bore down, unsure at first, but steadily applying more force. The blade slipped and skittered along the turtle's belly, leaving a milky scratch on its shell. The turtle mewled. Its flippers oared in crazy circles. Its helplessness made it look stupid, comical. Max could do whatever he wanted to it. He refolded the knife and pulled out the leather awl, just a simple metal spike. He held the knife in both hands as if it were the T-handle on a TNT detonator box. He took a rough guess at where the turtle's heart might lie, then hunched his shoulders and bore down with all his weight. The spike pierced the turtle with the sound of a three-hole punch going through a thick sheaf of paper. Blood poured from the perfectly round hole, darker than Max had ever imagined. The turtle's back flippers clenched and unclenched spastically. Something dribbled out between those flippers, pearlescent roe that had the look of delicate soap bubbles. Max punched the leather tool through a second time. The turtle's body compressed under Max's weight, its chest buckling like when you press down on a plastic garbage can lid. Its flippers beat helplessly at the air. Blood burst out of the wound in a startling, syrupy gout. The smell was profoundly briny, as if the turtle's organs were encrusted with salt. Max punched the spike through again, again, again. The turtle gurgled, then made a fretful, stuttering sound. Icka, 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 as if it had a bad case of the hiccups. Max groaned and sawed his arms across his eyes. He'd begun to cry without being aware of it, and stared at the turtle with eyes gone swimmy with tears. Blood was coming out of it all over. It rocked side to side frantically. A low, venomous hiss came out of the punctures. It was as if the turtle's organs had vaporized into steam that was now venting through those fresh holes.
Please, Max said.
He punched the spike through again. It went in so goddamn easy now.
as if the turtle's skin had relinquished its prior rights of refusal. Please, won't you just die? But it would not. Stubbornly, agonizingly, it clung to life. Its head craned up to take in the bloody wreckage of its own body. Its eyes were set in nets of wrinkles, inexpressive of any emotion Max could name. Its will to live was terrifying as it rejected the notion of an easy death. Why had he done this? Why? Jesus. Oh, Jesus. On TV, it was always so quick and easy, almost bloodless. The detective shot the murderer and he collapsed, clutching his heart. Or the knife slid in soundlessly and some guy went down clutching his stomach, venting a sad, sighing note, "Ugh!" before he died. But it didn't work that way in real life. Suddenly, Max understood those awful stories he'd seen on the national news, the ones where a reporter grimly intoned some poor person had been stabbed 40 times or whatever. Maybe the stabber would have stopped after a single stab if that was all it took. But most living things don't want to die. It took a lot to kill them. Events take on a vicious momentum. All of a sudden, you're stabbing as a matter of necessity. You're hoping that if you just put enough holes into a body, the life will drain out and death will rapidly flow in. "Newt," he pleaded. "Newt, please." The boys knelt in the sand, wet and shivering. Sand stuck to the pads of their feet. Max was shaking and sobbing. He could never, ever be hungry enough to kill something if this is what it meant. The turtle was still hiccuping, but now those sounds were interspersed with frantic peeps, like a baby bird calling from its nest. Newton grabbed blindly for the turtle's head. He slashed wildly with his knife, trying to hack through its throat, but the turtle withdrew into its shell, and Newton's knife only cut a deep trench around its jawbone. WWAMD. Not this. Alex would never have done this. Newton burst into a freshet of tears. "I'm sorry," he said, his chest hitching uncontrollably. "I thought that might be the quickest way, you know, cut its head off, like a guillotine. A terrible thing to do, but still better than..." The turtle peered out from the leathery cave where its head now rested. Its eyes blinked slowly. Its mouth opened and closed like a man at the end of a long run. Blood filled the lower hub of its shell and dripped onto the sand. It kept peeping and peeping. The boys knelt with their shoulders bowed as the turtle bled to death. It took so, so long. At one point, its head poked out of its shell. Its blood-slicked eyes stared around as if in hopes that its tormentors had grown bored of their sport and left it alone. Maybe it thought it could still return to the tide pool and be carried back into the ocean. Animals never gave up hope, did they? But its glazed eyes found them, blinked once, and resignedly returned to the darkness of its shell. The great wave of the tide moved farther inland. The water lifted. The surf sucked at the boy's bare feet. The turtle's flippers went stiff all at once, then relaxed. Tiny, translucent creatures that looked like earwigs crawled out from the deep folds of its skin to trundle over its cooling body, aquatic parasites looking for a new host. "I'm not hungry anymore," Newton said. "Me either. My mother says you can't really love yourself if you hurt animals." "I didn't mean to. Not like this. If I'd known." "I know. It's over now, anyway." The water lapped at their feet with a dreadful languidness. The gulls hurled down shrill shrieks from high above. The wind whispered in a language they could not name. They buried the turtle in the forgetting sand of the beach. Devourer versus Conqueror Worms, The Dual Nature of the Modified Hydatid. Excerpt from a paper given by Dr. Cynthia Preston, MD, Microbiology and Immunology at the 27th International Papillomavirus Conference and Clinical Workshop at the University of Boston, Massachusetts. The second breed of worm, the conqueror, is more interesting than the devourer. It is, for lack of a better term, a smart worm. As we know, the ability to manipulate the physical makeup of their host is a trait of some tapeworms. Take the African worm, H. diminuta. Their primary hosts are beetles, who frequently ingest rat droppings infected with tapeworm eggs. The first thing H. diminuta does upon entering a host is to locate the reproductive organs and release a powerful enzyme sterilizing the beetle. Why? So that the beetle does not waste any more energy on its reproductive system, allowing H. diminuta to further exploit the beetle's metabolic resources. This is one such display of the manipulative intellect of tapeworms. Dr. Edgerton's conqueror worms work in concert with the devourer worms, or more accurately, they abet the devourer's massive appetite. Once the mutated hydatid enters a host, it forms a colony in the host's intestinal tract. Once situated, a single conqueror worm emerges. The exact biology behind this is unknown. Theoretically, it may be similar to the method by which a bee colony selects its queen. The conqueror worm is significantly larger than its devourer brethren. It perforates the intestinal wall and makes its way to the spinal column. From there, it ascends to the base of the brainstem. Some conquerors twine around the host's spine, climbing it in a manner of creeping ivy climbing a parapet. Others infiltrate the column itself by easing through a gap in the vertebral discs and entering the host's cerebral spinal fluid. As it ascends, the conqueror lays eggs. These are reserve conquerors, one might say, in the event the queen expires. The conqueror larvae swim through the host's bloodstream and infect the strata of muscle tissue in the host's extremities. They are what account for the bee-stung look on several of Dr. Edgerton's test subjects. These are nesting conquerors. This is also a sign of a full-blown, late-stage infestation. Once the conqueror worm enters the cranial vault, it injects a powerful neurotransmitter into the host's basal ganglia. The purpose is simple. It puts the host's appetite into overdrive. Imagine a car with a brick wedged on the gas pedal. That's the runaway hunger drive that a conqueror kindles in its host. All the host wants to do is eat. In time, what it eats ceases to matter. Whether it's nutrient-rich or even properly food isn't something the host takes into account. Anecdotal evidence taken from Edgerton's lab indicates that the conqueror worm's neurotransmitter may have several other hallucinogenic or psychotropic effects. Edgerton's videos show animal subjects behaving incredibly oddly. At times, they appear to be unaware what is happening to them. Perhaps there is a masking effect. The host views itself as healthy, even healthier than before, while the devourer worms destroy it. This may enable the hosts to maintain a positive outlook, making them more productive, therefore gathering more food, therefore prolonging the lives of the worms. Otherwise, they may have simply given up and died. The conqueror worm's primary value to its colony may be the propagation of a positive mindset of its host. The longer the host believes it can survive, the more the colony can feast upon it. Testimony given by the lone survivor of the Falstaff Island tragedy seems to justify this hypothesis. The boy stated that his infected troopmates seemed, and I quote, stronger, happier even when they were falling apart. They couldn't see themselves for what they really were.
Chapter 31 Eve, Eve, you still there?
The knife slipped from Ephraim's hands. It kept on slipping. He couldn't get a good grip. It was all the blood. His hands were greasy with it. It shone on his fingers like motor oil in the moonlight. He'd seen it. He'd cut a satisfyingly deep crescent around the knob of his ankle bone. He glimpsed sly movement there. A faint pulsation that on any other day he might have dismissed as the heavy beat of his heart through a surface vein. But now, today, no. He cut too deeply. He knew this immediately. His hands had been shaking too hard in his excitement, in his need to find it. His skin opened up with a silky sigh, as if it had been waiting all his life to split and bleed. The inner flesh was a frosty white, as if the blood had momentarily leapt clear of the wound. In that instant, he'd seen it. Terror had seized his heart in a cold fist. Undeniably, it was inside him, feasting on him, coiling round his bones like barbed wire around a baseball bat. But on the heels of terror came a strange species of relief. He was right. It was just like Shelley promised. He wasn't crazy.
Shell?
He coughed. A carbolic taste slimed his tongue in his sinuses and lungs, burrowing into his bones to infuse the marrow with the flavor of tar.
Where did you go?
I've been here all along, friend. Don't you remember?
Ugh, was all Ephraim said.
A warm, slug-like blob passed over his lips, falling to the carpet of pine needles with a wet plop. Ephraim couldn't see what it was, didn't want to.
Did you see it, Eve? What did it look like?
He'd only seen a flash. It was thicker than Ephraim ever thought possible, fat as a Shanghai noodle. Its head, he'd found the head, split into four separate appendages. They looked spongy but predatory too, like the petals of a lotus blossom or a snake's head primed to strike. It had flinched like an earthworm when you ripped back a patch of grass to find it squirming in the dark loam. Its body had whipped madly about as it withdrew into the sheltering layers of his muscle tissue.
Oh, no, you don't, Ephraim had hissed.
He dug his fingers into the wound and tweezed with his fingertips. He felt the bare nub of his ankle bone, cold as an ice cube. His fingers closed around the worm. He was sure of that, almost sure. The parted lips of his flesh were rubbery and slick, gummed with the blood that was still flowing quite freely. He'd gotten hold of it, just barely, a strand of spaghetti cooked perfectly al dente, to the tooth, as his mother would say, a mushy exterior with the thinnest braid of solidity running through it. Did worms have spines? Maybe this one did. Squeezing his fingers, he'd tried to pinch his nails together, praying he could decapitate the horrible thing. Afterward, he figured he could pull the rest of its limp body out using the Swiss Army knife tweezers. If he was unsuccessful, he guessed it would just rot inside of him. It might create internal sepsis. His innards could be riddled with ulcerated boils and pus-filled lesions. He might die screaming, but at least he'd die empty rather than infested. He'd die totally alone. In that moment, he'd thought, do I really want that, to die alone? Where were Max and Newt? It was nearly dark by then, and they'd promised to return. Instead, they'd abandoned him. Max, his best friend, had left him alone. Friends until the end? Bullshit. Ephraim only had one friend left in the whole world. He'd gripped it, the tips of his fingers pincering the hateful thing. For an instant, it had thrashed fretfully between his fingertips. Ephraim was pretty sure, anyway. But he'd pulled too quickly. It squirted through his fingers. He'd reached again, desperately. Gone. He'd had his opportunity and lost it. It was safe inside him again.
It got away, Shell,
Ephraim said with despondent, childlike petulancy, marble-mouthing his words on account of the warm syrup in his mouth.
You have to keep trying. Or are you weak? A sucky baby like everyone says?
What?
Who'd have the balls to... Nobody said that. Did they?
He pictured them on the schoolyard, a gaggle of boys casting glances over their shoulders, sneering and laughing. He saw Max laughing at him. Rage tightened the flesh of his forehead. Something thorny and superheated surged against his skull, threatening to shatter through.
I hear it all the time, friend. At school, behind the utility shed where the big boys smoke cigarettes, they say Ephraim Elliott acts tough, but he's a pussy. He's a cuckoo. His mommy makes him see a shrink because his head's all messed up.
Ephraim's gaze fell upon his stomach. His shirt had ridden up to expose a slip of taut flesh. It rippled as something surged beneath it. Maddening, mocking, playing peekaboo. Ephraim picked the knife up. The blade was still keen. How deep could he cut? It all depended. How deep did his enemy lie? What would you rather? From Troop 52, Legacy of the Modified Hydatid, as published in GQ magazine by Chris Packer. Big Jeff Jenks, as the locals call him, isn't so big anymore. The events on Falstaff Island shrunk him. He admits as much himself. And from a man like Jenks, still possessed of a larger-than-life self-image, this is a big admission indeed.
I stopped eating for a while there, he tells me as we take a spin in his cruiser down the sedate streets of North Point. The appetite just wasn't there. Used to be before a shift I'd head down to Sparky's Diner and mow through their breakfast platter. Eggs, rashers of bacon, pancakes, toast, plenty of coffee. And this was after my wife had made breakfast at home.
Nowadays, Jenks's frame might charitably be described as utilitarian, although the word threadbare comes to mind. He floats inside his old police uniform. His arms sticking out of the double extra-large shirt sleeves put me in mind of a child trying on his father's clothing. When he leans over to hawk phlegm out of the window, I see the fresh holes he's punched in his old belt so that it cinches his dwarfed waistline.
It was just the toughest thing I ever had to do, he says distantly. Just sit on my hands and wait. That's not me, right? When something needs doing, I'd always stepped in to get it done. Round here, my word is law. But now, here were these MPs and high army muckety-mucks saying I couldn't go get my own damn kid.
He lapses into silence before saying,
My love can't save him. I remember thinking that. I think all of us, the parents, you know, were thinking the same thing. All the love in your body, every ounce of will you possess, matters nothing at all.
Though he admits the decision to steal Calvin Walmack's boat was a foolish one, he stands by it.
You're telling me that most every responsible, loving father on God's green acre wouldn't have done the same? Now, what the military won't admit, and never will, I'll bet, is that those MPs beat me and Reggie pretty bad after they ran us down.
He pulls up his shirt to show me a long, roping scar running up his hips to the bottom of his ribcage.
They beat me so hard with batons that they busted the skin wide open, right there on the deck of the boat. They didn't say anything while they were at it, either. Just a long, silent beating. Reg got it just about as bad. We didn't think to fight back. The MPs all had guns.
His voice drops to an agonized whisper.
Fact is, I'd never been beat anything near that. Not by anyone, ever. I was always the one doling that kind of stuff out. But only if you forced my hand.
We drive up rows of old Cape Cods, their exteriors permanently whitened by the salt spray that blows over the bluffs. It's a beautiful town, Anne of Green Gables pretty, the sort of place Norman Rockwell would paint.
The official report is nobody knows exactly what happened to my son, Jenks says. But I'll tell you, that boy was a survivor. That's the way I raised him. You can't be Jeff Jenks's kid and not be a tough son of a bitch. But then, what you're talking about, the enemy, I guess you call it, them. I mean, how can you fight something like that?
He drums his fingers on the wheel. A big vein ticks up the side of his neck.
They never found him. Never could bring my son's body home for us to bury, just to give me and my wife some closure, right? Kent's still technically considered missing. That's how it is in the books. And I tell you, man, missing can be worse than dead. Missing is like a book with the last few pages torn out, or a movie missing the final reel. Missing means you'll never really know how it ends.
He looks as though he might break down, but pulls himself back together.
So I guess I'll never really know, he says, after a while. There's not a lot of evidence to go by, is there? But I'll tell you this, my boy wouldn't go down without a fight. I'd bet everything I own on that.
Chapter 32. Kent was a beast. He could kill at will. For a while there, he'd thought differently. When the other boys had left him in the cellar, abandoned him like a whipped dog, he'd been scared, so scared. He'd felt his strength seeping away like the air from a leaky tire. The things that lived in him now were awesomely hungry. He knew they were there. He'd lain on the dirt floor and felt them sliding around inside him. A soft whisper came to his ears, a million snakes slithering across frictionless sand. The thought occurred to him, he could die here. It didn't quite seem possible. He was only 14. Didn't God look out for drunks and children? That's what his father always said.
At some point, Shelley had come to the cellar doors to feed him. The peanut brittle did nothing to kill his appetite. But whatever Shelley had given him next, tough and rubbery on the exterior, bursting with warm softness within, now that made him feel great. Still, Shelley had been a bad boy. Shelley had promised meat, and Kent would soon get what he was owed. Fresh energy percolated through him. His blood zitzed with adrenaline. He felt as though he'd eaten a raw steak. Shelley should have brought me steak. You should never go back on your word, Shelley, you scumbag, as he inhaled the scent of blood that was not his own. Kent was powerful. Oh, yes. He stood in the cellar, shoulders hunched. He could feel new bones growing up his back. They clawed through muscle and tendon before breaking through the skin on both shoulders. It was perfectly painless. He imagined this was what a caterpillar felt like when it emerged from its chrysalis as a beautiful butterfly. Brand new strength shot through him. Pounds of fresh muscle were slabbed onto his arms and legs. His chest cracked apart and widened as his shoulders grew broader and thicker. He did not feel pain or fear anymore. Was this how a superhero felt? Or a god? Was that what he was now? Weak light streamed through the chinks in the floor, falling across his new contours. His body was a mass of fast-twitch muscle fibers and vein-riven flesh. He laughed, a low baritone. He could smash through the cellar door if he wanted to. He could find the boys who'd locked him up and tear their bodies apart like paper dolls. Find Ephraim, son of the no-good jailbird, and crush his skull to splinters. Perhaps he would. Or perhaps he would be merciful. But for now, he'd wait. They would see him soon enough, although their tepid hearts might burst at the sight of him. When the other boys didn't return by nightfall, Shelley decided to kill Kent. That was the thing about spinning so many plates. Inevitably, one would topple off the pole. But the prospect of watching those plates shatter excited Shelley enormously. He'd found a dead sheep's head on the beach. It had washed in with the afternoon tide, rotted and picked at by sunfish. He skewered it on a sharpened stick and carried it back to the campfire. It was near dark when he stole around to the cellar with the dead fish. His breath came heavily, like a moose in rut. A dank musk dumped out of Shelley's pores, sour adrenaline mixed with something else, something fouler. Shelley jimmied the stick loose from the cellar doors and flung them open. The granular light of dusk sifted down the steps. Shadows twisted on the warped wood. Shelley took a cautious step forward, hunting for movement in the gloom. Kent? Shelley's prey dragged himself up the steps tortuously, a ghoul crawling out of a shattered coffin. For an instant, Shelley thought he had no skin. It was just a shambling, jerking Kent skeleton advancing upon him. As he drew closer, Shelley realized that the thinnest stretching of skin still clad Kent's wasted frame. He was covered in bulging boils. They looked like halved golf balls under his flesh. His eyes were cored sockets. Shelley was amazed they hadn't fallen out of his head to dangle by their glistening ocular stalks. Kent rose from the cellar, exultant. The newly crowned king, his body shone like rippled steel in the moonlight. Power and strength coursed through him. He was unstoppable. He came slowly, savoring it. His feet echoed on the steps like distant thunder. He curled his hands into fists and watched heatless lightning crackle and pop between his knuckles. He could kill a man with a look, with a simple thought. He had eaten the godhead and taken its power. Shelley stepped back in wonderment. He couldn't believe that Kent was still able to move. The boy's eyes were yellow and diseased. His lips had receded into the gauntness of his face. He shuffled out of the cellar with sickening animation, a gleeful marionette in the hands of a spastic puppeteer. The fleshless pinworms that were his lips skinned back to disclose a dizzying grotesquerie. His gums had been eaten back from his teeth, and all but one, his left front incisor, had loosened and fallen from their gum beds, yet they remained connected by Kent's braces, gray teeth linked like charms on a gruesome bracelet, clinking and clacking in the dark vault of his mouth, all hanging by that one tenacious tooth, which, as Shelley watched, slid from Kent's gums with a slick sucking sound, a bracelet of teeth bouncing over his lips, his chin tumbling to the cellar steps. Kent stepped on them, oblivious to his own teeth shattering like ribbon candy.
"Why are you doing that?"
the boy thing croaked.
"What are you looking at?"
"Almost nothing," Shelley said in a tone of pure awe. The Kent thing held out its driftwood arms, fleshless fingers outstretched toward the rotted meat in Shelley's hands. The weakling cowered at the sight of him. Shelley had glimpsed Kent's newfound beauty and power, and he was quailing in fear, as it should be. This puling wretch, Shelley held out an offering with one quaking hand, a hunk of braised meat dripping with juices. Perhaps Kent would be merciful. Perhaps Shelley would be spared. Shelley led the Kent thing past the fire. The thing shambled awkwardly, staggering and collapsing and dragging itself up. It made the sucky, drooling sounds of a revolting, starved infant. Saliva dripped from its flapping gums to slick its filthy scout uniform. Moonlight glossed the dome of its skull, which was covered in bloody patches. My God, it must have torn out its own hair and eaten it.
"Come on, Kent," Shelley cooed. "There's a good boy."
The Kent thing loosed a high, gibbering cackle. Nightbirds screeched from their roosts in the trees stitching the shore. They were down at the water now. Shelley waded in. The Kent thing blundered in after, slipping on the rocks while Shelley stared with sick wonder.
"What are you?" he said.
Shelley tossed the dead fish into the surf. The Kent thing shambled after it. Its bone-like fingers punctured the rotted flesh. Its toothless mouth tore a stinking strip off.
"So good. Thank you. So good."
Shelley knelt beside the Kent thing. He was aware of the danger but couldn't help himself. He craved this closeness. He petted its head the way you'd pet a dog. His rock-hard penis pressed urgently against the wetted fabric of his trousers. A tenacious chunk of Kent's hair came away in Shelley's hand. It pulled free with no resistance at all, like wiping cat hair off a velour cushion.
"Show me," he said softly.
Kent turned to regard him. Flecks of rotted fish clung to his jaws. His mouth hung open at a quizzical angle.
"What?"
Shelley gripped Kent's head and lowered it into the water. It didn't require much effort at all. He caught the stunned expression on Kent's face as he went under. His arms flailed, his legs kicked weakly. Air bubbles stormed to the surface, bursting with liquid pops. His uniform rode up his back. Shelley saw the pulsing tube running next to his spinal column. It looked like an awful second spine. Kent's struggles weakened. Shelley hauled his head up. The Kent thing's eyes were foggy. White worms had pierced the skin of his neck, writhing furiously.
"Show me," Shelley said anxiously. "I want to see."
The illusion shattered abruptly. The mental scaffolding fell away, and Kent saw himself as he was. When that happened, he prayed a quick, fervent prayer that the sight would drive him insane. Better to be mad than to witness the devastation of his body from a sane person's perspective, to see the skin stretched like parchment over the warped sticks of his bones, his body hilled with huge lumps, white worms twisting out of them in a frenzy.
"Show me,"
Shelley said again. The Kent thing's eyes hung at half-mast. He coughed wretchedly. Something burst from his mouth, a fine mist spraying Shelley's face. Something fluttered against his nose and lips like the beat of a moth's wings. Shelley stuck his tongue out involuntarily to clear it away, realizing in some dim chamber of his mind the terrible danger he was in, but the fear was washed away on the tide of his awful, powerful needs.
"Show me."
Shelley wasn't even sure what he was looking for. Did he want to watch Kent's soul depart his body? Would it slip away behind the convex curve of the Kent thing's eyes like smoke through a glass bowl? He dunked Kent's head underwater casually,
he hummed an off-key note while Kent thrashed and bucked. Chili felt insistent wriggles on his tongue and swallowed without quite realizing it. The Kent thing's limbs settled. Shelley turned him over so that he faced the sky. His eyes stared glassily through the salt water. Either Kent had been fooled or he'd fooled himself. He gazed at the airless vault of the heavens stretching above the ocean. The stars were white-hot, encircled by gauzy coronas. So lovely. The unfairness of it all came crashing down. He'd never tell a girl he loved her, never see his parents' faces again, never sprint across the outfield at the Lions Club Park tracking a long fly ball. This fact leapt straight out at him. The world was not a fair place. His father had lied, or he'd just been plain ignorant. He'd never see his father again to tell him just how wrong he was. Never, never, never. A look of terror and loss came across the Kent thing's face. Shelley's heart trembled. Joy washed over him in an awesome wave. Yes, yes, this was what he'd been looking for. Shelley set a hand on Kent's chest and pushed him under, hoping to lock that expression on his face. Bubbles detached from the inside of Kent's nostrils and floated up. A bigger bubble passed over his lips and burst on the surface with a wet pop. In the final moments, Kent's face settled into a calm and beatific expression. The joy burst like a glass globe inside Shelley's chest. His fingers dug into Kent's waterlogged uniform while he waded deeper into the sea, pulling the grotesquely buoyant Kent thing past the breakwater, infuriated for reasons he could not name. Shelley grabbed the stupid thing by its hair. It was dead now, and dead things relinquished their names, dragging it into the surf. It weighed almost nothing. The salt water held it up, its heels bumped over the rocks for 30-odd feet, but once Shelley had gotten far enough from shore, it floated freely like a piece of wood. The tide clutched greedily at the body. Shelley hesitated, not wishing to release it just yet. He was enraged. Vaporous, cresting surges of anger rocked through him. He'd expected so much more, some kind of revelation. A sign of the gears that meshed behind the serene fabric of this world, a glimpse of its seething madness. But no, in the end he'd seen only mocking resignation, and finally, bliss. He continued to drag the dead thing through the water. If he'd been paying closer attention, and usually he would have been, Shelley was a preternaturally aware boy, coolly observant of everything around him. He would have seen the thing's scalp detach from its skull. The skin had winnowed to a sheer rag-like substance that peeled as easily as the papery bark off a birch tree. If he'd not been in his own little reverie, he would have heard the sound of the dead thing's scalp tearing free of the bone, a watery sucking noise, little bubbles popping as the sea flooded in to kiss the naked skull bone. If he'd not been zoned out and oblivious, he'd surely have seen the thousands of white threads twisting out of the dead thing's head. Its skull, which was networked in fissures where the connective plates of bone had drawn thin and detached. They came out in snowy gouts, fanning out in numberless profusion, encircling Shelley's hips in a wavering nimbus. His reverie broke only once they began to touch his skin, and the moment he realized this was the moment it ceased to truly matter. "Oh," Shelley said. He jumped in the water, a silly, girlish little hop. "Fishy," he said, believing that a sunfish or saltwater eel had brushed his thigh. But then he looked down, saw the worms streaming out of Kent's skull case, wriggling and darting. His rubbery face settled into an unfamiliar expression. Horrified revulsion. He stared, entranced. They were so small. The moon played over their bodies, almost shining right through them. They moved in hypnotic, transfixing undulations. He nearly laughed, not because the sight of them was funny, but because they didn't even seem a proper part of his existence. They were funny because they weren't entirely real. They flicked around him in playful patterns. There were just so many. They curled into one another, jesting and flirting. He felt something playing against his skin, but it was a distant, forgettable sensation. a sting on his hand, a light burning sensation like a wasp sting, only much less severe. It was followed by another and another, and Shelley was rocked by an abrupt surge of adrenaline. His fingers unkinked from Kent's hair, he beat the water with his palms frenetically, spastically. His gorge rose. They were everywhere, clinging to him somehow. He uttered shrill, nasal, squeaky notes of violent distaste. Yee! Yee! The threads became more animated. They poured out of the dead thing's skull, leaving a milky contrail in the dark water. It looked like a streamer fluttering from some grisly 4th of July float. They wriggled down Shelley's trousers, flitting and licking against his skin. He swept the water with his forearm, trying to propel them away. His fear was unlike any he'd ever known. It made him desperate. Water fanned up, each droplet alive with wriggling white, landing on his arms and neck and lips. He snuffled salt water up his nose, sputtering on it. He felt them inside his underwear. Some were so thin that they passed right through the weave of the fabric, needling inside, finding the sensitive skin at the bulb of his penis, the little hole where the piss came out. Kent's body floated out past the breakwater. Threads continued to spill from it, sifting down through the water. The stars played their metallic light upon the waves. Kent was a silver shape dressed in the brightness of the moon. Smaller shapes, inquisitive fish, darted at his appendages, fussing with his fingers and hair. Later, Shelley dragged himself back to shore. He shambled up the beachhead in hesitant steps. His lower lip hung slackly, a globule of spit suspended from it. The glob stretched until it snapped, splashing the rocks. Tiny white things thrashed in the wetness. He returned to the campfire and stared at its dead embers. The walkie-talkie was there, but the game with Ephraim was a distant concern. He could resume it when Ephraim returned. If. A gray curtain draped over Shelley's thoughts, but beneath it and around its edges, things jigged and capered. His hand kneaded his crotch anxiously. The pleasure he'd experienced earlier with Kent was gone. Now that area itched and burned. Could be a case of crotch crickets. Shelley had once overheard a construction worker saying that to his buddy while clawing ruefully at his groin. Shelley was pretty sure this wasn't crotch crickets. It was a burn, a painful one, inside of him now. It had raced up his piss pipe like lit gunpowder, a bright and lively pain that ebbed to a strange hum inside his skin. Now he felt it spreading through him in slow, sonorous waves. He bit his lip. He'd made a mistake. A big one, this time. Gotten carried away with his games. Lost sight of the danger. It was only for a second, though, an internal voice whined. Just a heartbeat. He sat cross-legged on the dirt. The burn receded. As the moments passed, it didn't feel so bad at all. A comforting numbness coursed through his limbs, his veins filling with some wondrous, warm nectar. His stomach, though, that was grumbling, revving up, roaring. Shelley's hands clenched, tearing up clumps of dirt. Without realizing or truly caring, he filled his mouth with the contents of his hands. He chewed methodically, grit and shell shards ground between his teeth. It sounded like he was eating handfuls of tiny bones. Bleh, he said, letting the half-chewed mess fall out of his mouth. His tongue was a blackened root. He looked like a ghoul who'd been eating his way down to a coffin. Nobody loves me. Everybody hates me. I'm going to the garden to eat worms. To eat worms. Shelley began to laugh. A high, piercing sound like the scream of a gull. It stripped out over the water, touching not one pair of human ears. Shelley sat that way for a few hours. He did not speak. He was motionless, except for a brief spell where he shook uncontrollably, unable to control his limbs. When the sky reached its deepest ebony, Shelley began to feed in earnest. Chapter 33. Newton built a fire on the beach using the driftwood he and Max gathered. It took quite a while to get it lit. His fingers were shivering badly. After it was going, they huddled on the sand with their shoulders touching lightly. Both of them had stripped to their skivvies. Newton's field book advised against staying in wet clothes. The water dried on their naked flesh, leaving a whitened sheen of salt. Their internal temperatures inched back up. They hadn't spoken since burying the turtle, which they'd done before building the fire. Every so often, their gazes drifted to the spot on the beach where the sand had been smoothed by their trembling palms. Newton's eyes found Max's above the fire.
"Do you think it will go to heaven?"
"The turtle?" Max's shoulders lifted imperceptibly. "I really don't know. It could. If there is a heaven, I guess it ought to. I mean, right? What would that turtle ever have done not to deserve to go to heaven?"
Newton's shoulders relaxed, then stiffened again as a worried cast came over his face.
"What about the Scoutmaster?"
Max frowned.
"Why are you asking me?"
"Your dad's the county coroner. He works with the priests and pastors, yeah? I figured he'd know."
For all of Newton's smarts, he could be incredibly thick-headed.
"I don't know, Newt. I'm not the one who makes those choices, am I? Nobody really knows. Not my dad or priests or anyone. I guess when we die, we'll know who was right about everything."
"But Scoutmaster Tim was a good person."
Max blew a lock of damp hair off his forehead.
"Sure, he was. He was a doctor. He helped people. I guess. Yeah, he'd go to heaven."
"Do you think he's there now, looking down?"
"Depends on how long it took him to get there. Maybe he had a few stopovers."
Max saw the look of dread on Newton's face and said,
"Yes, he's up there. He's happy now."
"I never saw a dead person before, Max."
"I never saw a dead person like that either."
"Were you scared?"
Max nodded.
"You didn't look scared."
"Well, I was."
The night's silence stretched over the immensity of the ocean, an impossibly quiet vista that stirred fear in Max's heart. Would death be like that? Endless liquid silence? Newton grabbed a piece of wood from the pile, inspecting it by the fire's glow. A black spider picked its way across it. Newton let it crawl onto his fingers.
"Careful," Max said. "What if it's poisonous?"
"Poisonous ones have red bells on their abdomens. This one's pure black."
It climbed off his fingertip. Newton watched it go with a dreamy look.
"A spider used to live inside Mom's car," he said. "She parked it under the oak in our driveway. Every time she took the car out, she'd see a web hanging between the side view mirror and the windshield. She would snap it. The next time she looked, it'd be back. Finally, she tilted the side view mirror as far as it would go and looked into the compartment behind. A little white spider was living in there. Every night it came out and strung a web. Mom would come out and snap it, so it would just build it again."
"Did she kill it?" Max said.
"Absolutely not," Newton said fiercely. "Who was it hurting? She even left its web alone from then on. But then one day we were driving and I spotted the spider on the windshield. We were doing like 80 tooling down the highway to Charlottetown. It was trying to build another web on the windshield while the car was ripping down the road. I thought it would blow away. I could see the sunlight glinting on the web, and it managed to lay down. Crazy, right? Mom pulled over. We took the spider and put her in an apple tree along the road, her new home."
Newton smiled. Max figured he was reliving the memory. On the roadside, on a wet spring day, the cree-cree of crickets in the long grass, as his mother let the little spider slip off her finger onto the branch of an apple tree, clung with pink blossoms. It was a nice image.
"After we got back on the road, Mom said, insects can make a home for themselves almost anywhere. They say that about cockroaches. If there's ever a global Armageddon, they'll be the only things left. You can't beat a bug for adaptability."
"I think humans can be the same way, too. Don't you think, Max? If we really need to, we can survive almost anywhere."
Knot holes popped in the fire. Max's ears became attuned to another sound, febrile cracking noises coming from the darkness where the rocks met the beach near the spot where they had buried the turtle.
"You hear that, Max?"
Hear what? Newton got up and crept toward the noises. His mind conjured up an absurd image that was nonetheless chilling. The reanimated sea turtle clawing itself up from its sandy grave, blood dripping from its puncture wounds, its bone-like mouth snap-snapping. The fire threw wandering sheets of light upon the rock. The crackling noises grew louder. They were joined by other sounds overhead, the rustle of wings in the cliffs. Oh my God! A clutch of pale green eggs, the patina of the sea, were buried in the sand, each about half the size of a chicken egg. They had been covered in a fine carpet of sand. The boys had totally missed them. Each egg was struggling with minute, hectic life. Shards of shell broke off. The tiny limbs of unknown creatures were pushing themselves out.
What are they?
Max said. They didn't have to wait long to find out. When the first flipper appeared, Newton whispered,
"They're turtles."
The scenario played out in Max's mind. A mama turtle swims in with the high tide to lay her eggs. She gets stuck in a tide pool. Next, a pair of horrible two-legged things blunder into the pool, heave her onto the sand, and... The baby turtles didn't even look like turtles, the same way those baby shearwaters on the kitchen table hadn't really looked like birds. They had no real shell, only a translucent carapace draping their grape-sized bodies. You could see through their skin as if through a greasy fast-food bag, the dark pin bone of their spines, the weird movement of their organs. For all their newborn freshness, they still looked ineffably old. Max reached to touch one. Newton grabbed his wrist. You can't. If it gets human smell on it, its mom won't take it back. It took a moment for it to sink in. Let's just get them into the water, Max said softly. Newton nodded. I guess it's okay to touch them for that. With infinite care, the boys picked up the baby turtles and carried them across the sand. They tenderly picked the shards of eggshell off their bodies. They knelt at the shore and let them go. Their flippers paddled as they made a beeline for the open sea. The air above was alive with harried wing beats and livid screeches, the bats and gulls having been thwarted in their attempt to poach an easy meal. The boys made sure every turtle made it safely into the water. The birds made crazed dive bombs, their wings pelted the ocean, desperate to snag the babies before they submerged.
No, you bastards!
Max stumbled into the water, waving his arms. He shadowed the turtles into deeper waters, wading out as they skimmed through the sea, coaxing them lightly with his hands.
Go on now, swim, swim, fast as you can.
The water rose to his stomach. The riptide sucked at his legs. Only then did he reluctantly return to shore, dripping and shivering. They returned to the fire. Newton smiled wanly and made a check mark in the night air.
That's our good deed for the day.
From Troop 52, Legacy of the Modified Hydadid, as published in GQ magazine by Chris Packer. Like Tom Paget, Dr. Clive Edgerton has earned his fair share of nicknames. Dr. Mengele 2.0, Dr. Death. Then there are the garden variety appellants that society as a whole tends to apply to men like him. Megalomaniac, mad scientist, psychopath. Then there is the sobriquet that Dr. Edgerton himself insists you call him by. It was, in fact, one of the conditions of our interview. The title he's rightfully earned, having graduated with top honors from the finest medical learning institute on the East Coast. Doctor. Dr. Edgerton is most likely pathologically insane, says his administering physician, Dr. Loretta Hughes. If you look at the things he has done, compounded by his near-total lack of remorse regarding them, you can't help but draw that conclusion. She leads me down an austere hallway inside Kingston Penitentiary, her crepe-soled shoes whispering on the pea-green tiles. Edgerton has been incarcerated here in the mental health wing since his arrest. The ensuing trial became a sensation. Edgerton had sat defiantly in the middle of the media storm. His shaven head and outrageous courtroom antics, the grandstanding, the fulminating, gave him the air of a revivalist preacher. The talking heads and pundits dined out for months on Edgerton's daily servings of bloody red meat. But perhaps he's not insane, Hughes tells me. The fact may be that his brain is simply unmappable. He is incredibly intelligent. I hate to use a cliche like off the charts, but the fact is that modern science has no real means to judge an intellect like his. It would have been the same with Leonardo da Vinci. The dividing line between genius and insanity is very thin and quite permeable, which is why so many geniuses descend into madness.